This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Release May 7th, 2023. Episode 631. A Noisy, Rude Bus.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
As always.
Yeah. I was watching your 10 years of...
Dumpster diving.
Digging through the dumpster diving. And you know what the number one thought I had was?
What?
Where did all that crap go? Do you actually put it back in the dumpster? Because I really hope you do it most of the time.
A very, very little of it goes back into the dumpster.
Wow.
Like the computers and the monitors and stuff I keep, give away, use. Like I'm using dumpster computers at home, here, everywhere, you know.
Bitcoin mining. Yep. He's still doing it. One person. He's the last person. He's the last holdout.
Right.
Just because he finds so much crap at the dumpster room.
A lot of them are stockpiled. You know, I gave away 15 monitors once, and then I gave more away when I moved the labs. I gave 15 computers, like small form factor computers, away when I moved lab last time. You know,
hey buddy, you want to buy a CRT?
I've still got the two CRT TVs. They're kind of handy for old school retro stuff, you know, things like that.
Sure.
I'm using a network switch I found in the dumpster. I'm using a couple of network switches I found in the dumpster. You know.
Yeah. This is what I'm going to recall next time you complain that the lab's really cluttered as well.
Right.
Well,
that's why I've got two storage units, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, the chair I'm sitting on now found in the dumpster. You know, you
should just move the sign for the dumpster room to your storage unit.
Dump
it directly in there. Yeah.
They have actually installed a camera in there now. After the signs threatening to do it for like a year and a half or something, there's finally a camera in there.
Are they real? I always love those kits you can buy where it's just a blinking LED.
I did actually trace the camera, and it goes, they've got one inside, they've got one outside, and it's tied into a... It turns out that it was... the reason I didn't know about it is because it was installed by the building next door, which also has access to the same garbage room. And they have a different strata committee, because I'm on the strata committee for this building. So there's no way they would have expensed it and installed it without me knowing. I wondered how or why they did this. And it was the building next door that paid for it. So So they must have been having issues. They got their strata committee got fed up or something with people dumping so much crap there. But they upgraded the whole security system for the building. So they got cameras all over the place now for the building next door. Whereas
it is really easy to upgrade security systems now with, like, you know, Wi-Fi sensors and all, like, the little thread and all the different sensors that are out there. You know,
yeah, but these ones are all wired. So yeah, I followed the conduit along. You know, they screwed it into the concrete roof, right?
That is the right way to do
car
it.
Park, and you know,
if you really want to do it right, that is definitely the right way to do it. But
you need power, right? So it's like, you know, you're going to have to install it where there's power if you're going to get the Wi-Fi thing. You can't just magically install the Wi-Fi thing, right?
Well, no, a lot of the SimpliSafe and other ones that are like kind of popping up, at least in the US, a lot of them are battery-based sensors, and then they'll be like Zigbee or like...
Yeah, but you can't have a camera. You can't have a camera with a battery-based thing.
Although, no, actually, they are doing... That is actually another thing, too. I've been surprised about that because I looked at this for my house, actually, and there was like, there's a Nest camera that's like wireless. And I was like, how the hell, you know, like there's no installation. Okay, fine, whatever. What you do is you basically, it's like this magnetic mount.
Yeah.
And then like once every, I guess during daylight or, you know, whatever, you pull these things off their mounts and you go plug them in and then you charge them up and they come back out. And it's like, oh, that's...
Well, yeah, but how long is a camera going to last on a charge?
I don't know.
I mean, that's just BS, right?
Yeah. I didn't buy it for a reason.
Right. No, I just can't picture that working. That's just dumb. And if you want to install something like that, you don't want to have to maintain it. You just want it to...
Yeah, I think that's right. You want it to be like
an appliance,
forget. Right?
Set and forget. Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Agree.
Yep. Yeah. You know, you install, you know, per motion sensors. You know, you install like a CR123 battery in there, and it lasts 5 years or something. You know, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But bloody camera, no.
Yeah, like read relays and motion sensors and stuff like that, where it actually activates and like cuts off the switch otherwise. Yeah. Mm. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, nah. All right. What have you been up to?
I've been turn it on. I've been writing music, Dave, for a demo I made. Here we go. Ready?
Yep. What? Is that it?
That's it. Yeah. So I've been working on Thingy 91, which is like a little platform for Nordic for their solving.
Right.
And they have a buzzer on there. You know, it's just a little piezo buzzer.
Yeah.
But like there are no examples on the entire internet. And I was like, I'm going to go make some examples for this. And like I was making demos for work.
Yeah.
And so, I guess I should probably turn it on and get the other ones playing.
So it's an actual buzzer at a fixed frequency. It's not a piezo transducer, which you can operate at any frequency. Which one is it?
It's the latter. Yeah. So it's like a NPN driving a piezo that you can drive.
Right.
A
okay. So basically, in theory, you can drive it at any frequency. Okay. Right. Right. So it's not that's a buzzer. Why A buzzer.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
a
I didn't
buzzer
know this. Okay.
Is defined. Yeah, a buzzer is defined as something that has its own internal oscillator and it oscillates at one frequency. It just
and
buzzes
what would you call
at
the other
one
then? Frequency. A piezo.
I would call it a piezo transducer.
Transducer. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so this is a piezo transducer.
Right.
And I've been using this thing to just make some silliness and
sweet.
It's been pretty good fun. Triggering stuff from the internet, of course. It's basically the most trivial internet machine I could make. So
right. Yeah.
among many other things that it does, but that's the most trivial part of it for sure.
Right. So is that the extent of your musical skills at the moment? I thought you were an actual muso, dude.
Well, I had to actually, because it was just like, I had to like set up kind of like a framework for it, because it's literally when you do a piezo, it's like, or sorry, when you do a PWM, it's like, well, okay, you give it a period and you give it a...
Yeah.
How much duty cycle it is, and that doesn't really translate to like notes.
Yeah, right.
So then I had to go and like write this note is this, and you've got a note library, a note
that's table right, exactly. or something. Okay, so you can choose your notes. Okay, right.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. Exactly. Rather than write a whole lot. You could have a library that takes in a waveform or something, and then
Yeah.
So in theory, you could actually make that talk. So
yeah, exactly. If I like learned phonemes and like did all that sort of stuff, right. I could go pretty insane with this sort of thing. But I probably will stop at a certain point. All right, let's see if the internet part works. Yeah, all right.
It's very old school Merlin. I've done a video on that old school Merlin, game from the 1970s, which used the world's first microcontroller. I'll try and get that video.
Okay. I mean, that was the Mario theme, right? That it wasn't very well done.
That was
the Mario Brothers theme. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And then I also did this one.
Got it.
Unfortunately, like part of my lab does not. Well, that didn't quite catch it, but that was Funky Town.
All right.
As you do.
Got it. Anyway, I sent you the link to the Merlin. Yeah,
and then I pretty much got bored with like putting in new songs. So, but I have the framework now, so I could put in other stuff.
Cool.
But monophonic, and I wrote a little song, and
groovy.
I put in two covers, and then that's about it. And then I moved on to the other stuff I had to do with it.
Yeah.
But they're triggerable over cellular from the internet, Dave. So that part's actually pretty cool.
Right? Is there like an online tool that you can put, like you can just give it a song, and then it gives you the notes out? Is that like a thing? Surely there is.
Well, I tried that with ChatGPT and it didn't quite get it right.
Okay.
The easy way to do that, I think, is like to just go and look up sheet music. But of course, you need to like read sheet music, which I do. Right. But other people might, if you don't have that experience, you might struggle with that.
That's why I'm thinking an online tool that can just spit out notes. Oh, it's a B, G, A, or whatever.
Yeah, I bet you could find something that would do that. I was actually looking for something. I was looking to see if there was other AI services. Of course, we already got into AI. I was looking for other AI services to see if it would like write me a song. I tried make it sound like a John Williams-esque theme. A Midjourney for music. And apparently, that is coming. Google has some demo. There's like a bunch of demo stuff out there, but none that are like services where I can just type stuff in and have it spit something out, which is fine.
Interesting.
But it is on the way. I forget what it's called for Google.
Right.
There's so many repeating elements in music, and there's actually like a court case that just concluded where Ed Sheeran's like a pop singer.
Yeah,
he was being sued by the estate of Marvin Gaye.
Copying something or what?
Yeah, they said that one of Ed Sheeran's songs sounded like Let's Get It On. So
I don't know it, but okay. Right. So they're claiming it was Yeah,
they're claiming that, and it's interesting. There's a couple of Adam Neely videos about it. Who's like a music YouTuber, pretty good.
Okay, yep.
But it's basically like he makes a really good point that like even though this is about that specific song, it's actually probably much more pertinent in the oncoming age of AI because like can you copyright kind of like a feeling of a song, right?
Right,
because it's not like not the same words, it's not the same, but it's like definitely in the same style, but like. That song, like the Marvin Gaye song, is like basically defining the style. And so like that does have some implications, I think, going forwards.
Yeah.
It seems for now AI is going to win the day.
Yeah. Well, that I coined a new term the other day on Twitter. I just sent you a link.
Okay.
Anxiety or anxiety. AI anxiety. You know, it is the feeling that you have when you think you may not have chosen the best, most optimum AI tool for the job. Because there's so many AI tools. Like there's a dozen new AI tools coming out every day now. It is insane. Yeah. And it's like, which one do you pick? Oh, I've got this task, but have I picked the right AI tool? Is this one going to, you know?
The only redeeming factor is that there's not really a whole lot of like skill building that goes into each new one. So that part's good.
It's just, but there's just like, there's thousands of them. Literally thousands of AI tools. It's just, and it's only going to get worse. It's just nuts.
Yeah.
So how, which one do you choose? Which one's the best for your task that you need doing? You know, there's 100 choices now.
I mean, it's coming for us, Dave, over time. Yep. I think it's all about like existing in the corners for now. Right. I mean, so that is honestly part of the reason it's not like a true concern, but I am interested more in like continuing to get better at firmware and stuff like that too, because it does feel like the board layout piece, it's much more like ubiquitous, which is actually great, I think, from an access perspective, but also like if I was going to be hired for my services in the future, I'm not sure it's as hireable. I guess you always have like people that, you know, you always have your reputation and like being able to solve problems. That part's not going away, I don't think. But I do wonder about the hardware versus the firmware piece. It does seem like the firmware piece is harder to solve in a lot of projects, or there's more stuff there. That's my gut feel.
Yeah, but you still need a program. You still need a good programmer to make sure to combine it all together and make sure the output from the AI is good. Right? So you still need those skills.
Yeah. Some kind of like judgment engine, right? Whatever it is, it's like, I think AIs will have fever dreams and think they've achieved the task, but they're, you know, being the third party in that case is still
you
valuable,
need
I
to,
guess.
Yes, there needs to be an adult in the room, so to speak.
And there you go.
you need to be the AI adult. And here is my tip for every youngster out there, right? There is a new technology that comes along once in a lifetime. Once or maybe twice in a lifetime, AI is it, right? So if you are not getting on this now, you should become the expert at whatever company you're working at. You should become the expert. Spend every waking hour. I'm not kidding. Spend every waking hour learning all the different things that AI can do. Become the expert. So when your company goes, oh shit, we have to do something with this AI, or you know, how can we optimize things? You can go, hey, I've been doing all this work on the side. I'm an AI expert. I can show you how it does this, and this, and this. And boom, you'll be the most valuable employee in the company.
That's interesting. It's not a bad, I don't disagree with it, but like when you say an expert.
You can't lose. You can't lose by spending your time learning all the different stuff that AI can do.
Yeah, but like
you don't necessarily have to be an expert. You just need to be smarter than, you need to know more about AI than everyone else in the company. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you just got
to
be faster than your slowest friend, right?
Yes, exactly. So no, you don't have to be some absolute guru, but you will appear as a guru, right?
No, I know. But what I'm getting at here is, do you think it's learning how to program and build your own, or is it just as a user?
Doesn't necessarily matter. You just have to, even if you just know which tools are applicable to which application and how to utilize them, that is more than enough skill. That's more than 99.9% of people who work at your company will know. right? Is how to use a particular AI skill for a AI tool for a particular purpose, and then how to drive it. And if you know that,
okay, yeah,
you are invaluable. I guarantee it.
I don't know. I guess I'm discounting the general ubiquity of all these things too. That like to truly stand out in that case, it doesn't really. Just knowing the tools doesn't feel like you would stand out in like a large organization that has potentially other young people there. That's the main thing that I'm resisting
but,
it.
But
for,
what you're not counting on is that most people are lazy.
Most people are lazy.
You can be the person who's put in the hard yards at night on weekends learning.
Yeah, doing projects for yourself.
Showing stuff that you can immediately show them.
That's a good point.
That you know what the hell you're talking about and you can actually apply this skill immediately.
Yeah, that's not bad. Okay.
Right? And trust me, you'll be the most valuable person in the company. Because every company is going to have to get on the bandwagon. They're going, oh, how do we... But they have no idea how to use it, right?
You'll be the Ryan Howard of your company. You'll go from being the temp...
Who's that? What's Ryan Howard? Oh, man.
That's a U.S. office, the office from the U.S.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's
right.
A reference to him. Right. Sorry.
Yep.
The people who knew it, though, they were like, yeah, I know that reference.
but the thing I'm saying is that this is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Very rare. Like, the internet was one of them, right? If you got on the early internet, stuff like that, right?
Right.
Name another thing, right? Well, it'd be personal computers in the late 70s, early 80s.
The printing press.
Right? Yeah, personal computers, desktop publishing, the internet. Like, I'm not thinking of much else, right?
Right. So I guess this is another piece of my resistance here, is that like, okay, so if you, so like, let's talk about the internet, right?
Yep.
Some people said, hey, I'm on Usenet forums. I know how to use this stuff. And they stayed in their company and they said, yeah, I'm the guy. And then they became the IT guy.
Right.
Other people did that, and then they went and started a business and sold to those IT guys, and they're billionaires.
Oh, sorry, I mean? Like, sure, yeah.
So I guess that's kind of just the stuff that's going through my head. I'm not saying that people should quit their jobs and go into AI.
But you need to get on this now so that either you can branch out on your own, right, and form your own company or form your own products or whatever it is, or you can be the most valuable person in your company, right? Mm. Either way is fine, right? I'm not talking about how to become super rich. I'm just, how to secure your future, right? And this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Do not pass it up.
If we are molding young minds, Dave, maybe we should tell them to shoot high. And then, worst case scenario, you become the IT guy.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's why you gotta work on stuff on your own time. And then this is
maybe that lands.
Midnight engineering stuff, right? This is classic midnight engineering we've talked about forever. Right?
Yes.
But do it for AI, because AI is the new game changer, right?
Yeah.
Be the most valuable person in the room when it comes to AI.
Yeah.
Yeah. It will not be a waste of time spending your time on that, right? Don't go out and party, kiddies, I'm telling you, right? Spend your waking hours learning AI.
I think what we might be deluding ourselves is that anyone under 18 or even under 25 is listening to the show right now. But if they are... First off, you're awesome. And also, you older folks, you're awesome too.
No, but how many college students would we have, right? Tons, I'm sure.
I don't know.
Right? Heaps.
I don't know, Dave.
Right? Stop partying, learn bloody AI, right? Get it. Don't be a lazy bastard, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true. Go hard. Yeah. No, I agree with that pace. Yeah. I don't know if I would have listened to it in my younger days.
I totally wish I had that advice back in the day. Learn it, go hard. I wasted so much time just bumming around being lazy, Yep. Totally regret that. Waste of time. Yep.
Dave, you can't regret it. It brought you here to this
very
moment.
Yeah, I know. But every step I did.
To the awesomest co-host you've ever had.
Right. I am not worthy.
So,
I am not worthy.
Yeah. No, that's what I was going to say.
Love it. Anyway. That's my tip for this week.
Well, another thing that I'm interested in terms of like future trends, I was just watching Wendover today, had a really interesting video about manufacturing in Mexico.
Oh, I have not seen that one yet.
It had peaked. Yeah, it just came out today and it piqued my interest because it was, I think the title was like Mexico is the new China kind of thing.
And,
that's like a buzzwordy kind of thing that's been written over and over again about
Vietnam I've been
and
hearing
India
that for years,
and
you know,
Brazil
yeah.
and all yeah. of, you know, like lots and lots of those. But I think, you know, he lays out a case for the logistical aspects of it in relation to the proximity to a very large market.
Simply being close is
totally
that is the border, right? It's right there.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's miles away, right? If you're talking like San Diego, it's like just sure. you can just walk over.
You
right?
literally walk over the bridge. Yep.
Yeah. 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 It's like, yeah, you it's know, nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I was wondering though is like I would love to hear from listeners is if you are doing manufacturing in Mexico and you're allowed to talk about it, of course, just like what's it like? I mean, first off, I felt like a little validation. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm learning Spanish and not Mandarin right now.
yeah, right.
But that's actually because I don't feel like I could learn Mandarin, and I don't really, you know, like.
Yeah, I would have that advice. I wouldn't be learning Mandarin.
You know, did I ever mention on the show? I think I probably mentioned on the show that I took Japanese in college.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like this trailing edge advice of like, you know, growing up in the 90s, people were like, oh, yeah, you got to learn Japanese.
When you're in college, the Japan thing was early 2000s. Like Japan was huge in the 80s, right? Japan, well,
And through the 90s, I think, too, right? I mean,
early
mid
90s. Yeah.
I mean, like, until a lot of the stuff shook out with like the memory wars and stuff like that, I feel like, yeah.
Yeah.
I also like Japanese culture, of course, but it definitely was on the back of like, oh, well, I'm doing engineering. This would be a good idea for like my career too, sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's something I can ask Steve Sangi next week.
Ooh, a little teaser there.
We have him booked. We have the CEO of Microchip, Steve Sangi, will be on next week. So, I'm going to record that on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Assuming nothing goes wrong. So, yes, send questions. I do have a Twitter thing down below.
Great.
And I ask that question. Everyone bitches me. You know, everyone bitches. When can I get my parts? When can I get my parts? Why does your software suck? You know, I can't ask him, why does your software suck? You know, I mean,
no, that'd be kind of rude.
Yeah.
You could ask that in a nicer way of like, what are some resources for engineers looking to learn your unique style of software?
Right. I can ask ChatGPT for a nicer way to say it.
Nice way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I think if you asked really rough questions, like, you know, he's the CEO, he knows how to like, you know, they've all had media training too. They know how to like get around questions. And
they
stuff,
know so, how to yeah. get around questions. Yeah. They know how
right.
to
No hard hitting answers for hard hitting questions on the Amp Hour. We're all about softballs around here, folks. what's the thing in relation to like Japan and China?
Yeah. I don't even know where they're making. I assume they're still making some chips in Arizona, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Are they? Yeah.
They are purported to be growing their fabs, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I think they were a part of the CHIPS Act. So that I think would be a good question.
Yep.
CHIPS Act and just like
what
other plans there.
Yes, the CHIPS Act and everything. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yep.
I'd also be interested about like, you know, just like, how's it going with eating Atmel?
Yeah, no, totally.
Are they digested yet?
Are they fully digested?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and like, I think that's got to be tough from a, you know, like you and I still talk about Burr Brown parts, right? Like,
oh, yeah. No, that's
TI
hard.
TI ate them, 35, 40 years ago? And like there's just, there's different operating groups. There's geographical differences. It's basically like there's the European Union, right? Which is this collection of many, many countries in the continental Europe. But like we wouldn't refer to like an Italian person the same way as you would a French person unless you want to get punched twice. Right?
I mean, like, exactly.
You know, like there's just like these cultural differences that like persist and people take pride in, and it's like it wouldn't be smart to do that culturally, I think, within a company either. So
I'd be interested about that dynamic. There's so much legacy in these, you know, because they all get gobbled up. We've covered it here on the Amp Hour. Like, it's just insane the amount of companies, semiconductor companies, that have been gobbled up. But
so that would definitely be interesting. What else would I ask Steve?
Well, I can ask him if anyone's attempting to buy Microchip.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be right out with that.
Oh boy.
Yeah, maybe I would be interested actually what it's like with a public company, you know, like for, you know, they make very complex things and like, and then you have people that are on Wall Street, you know, it's a public company, and just like, what is it like interacting with investors And do they have any semblance of the actual difficulty? You know, is it just like, hey, money machine, crank out more money? Or is it like actually that there's actual interest there? And yeah. like, does that drive business and growth and that sort of thing, you know?
One of my big questions is going to be supply chain, right? Because people think, engineers, right? We need the chips, right? We think the chip is the bottom. Like if we can't get our chip, right? That's to us, we don't care about the rest of it. Can we get the chips or not? Right. Yeah. But then the companies that manufacture the chips, they're going, oh, well, we need our silicon. We need our, you know, our wafers. We need all the chemicals that go into making them, you know, like that's a supply chain in itself.
Yeah. Everything ripples
right from the raw material upwards. So if they've got supply chain problems, like we think they're the bottom of the supply chain. It's turtles all the way down. Right.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. Right.
Oh boy.
We can't process the wafers until we have more machines, and the machines need wafers that are inside of chips. And oh my God.
I think I don't actually know that. Like, why is there a chip shortage? What is stopping you making the chips? There must be something further down the supply chain that's stopping them making it. Yeah, I know it was the whole COVID thing and they did predictions wrong and shut down. Then there was sudden demand and they couldn't get them and the big companies were buying them up. But is there something beyond that? I'm just curious.
I bet that's pretty big. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. It's interesting. I mean, like, and also like, you know, Steve's insight into the whole supply chain too, right? I mean, like the CEO needs to know a lot, but I'm guessing that it would be a big waste of his very expensive time that, you know, if like an operations manager in the silicon sourcing was like, you know, like he's giving him like one sentence for the investor meetings versus like, you know, like, Steve, can you help me solve this problem, please?
Yep. So, right.
The fact that he's talking to you is actually like, that's, we should ask how much it would cost. Like, what is he really giving up? What is the opportunity cost to come on the
what is
hour?
It? Well, I was struggling to get the full hour. It was like, oh, we might be able to get you half an hour. Yeah. You know,
we'll take whatever we can.
Yeah.
Just how about this? Whatever he doesn't fill into the full hour, then it's going to be me and you filling in with like,
an after
game show, like a sporting event, you know, and we're just going to fill in the details. So the more time he gives, the better it's going to be for the, you know, how they look.
Got it. Oh boy. Anyway,
we'll take whatever we get, though.
Yeah, we totally will. Yep.
Yeah. That's cool. Good. No, I'm excited. Right. That's really great. Yeah. It is. I mean, I don't know. It's, I don't know if you've been seeing stuff. We talked about, we've been talking about it a little bit. I guess when other Dave was here in Durham and we recorded, he was talking about it. He's a consultant, you know, just kind of like general loosening up of supply chain. And I forget who was on before Dave. We've been talking about supply chain a little bit though, and it seems like it is loosening up.
Right.
That's my general feel, and also like my digi-keying.
Depends on your luck. Like, you know, I hear people still, my business is totally shut down because I still can't get parts. You know, really? it depends on what part you've actually got. And
I dropped in on the Adafruit live show yesterday too. It was Phil and Lamore were talking about like, oh, we got a reel of, we managed to get this one reel and we're able to make this product now. And that felt like, you know, kind of like that stop start nature of it too.
That felt totally very
realistic too, of just like,
yes,
you just do what you can as you can and just hope you have the other parts that are necessary in the moment.
Exactly.
But I think that's how like the train kind of starts back up, you know, like it has to happen like that. And I think the thing that's really helping a lot of the things shake loose is people not scrambling, and they can go back to building like they had before, and like then they can start to build, you know, so now I'm not building with the parts that you needed, and you're not then scrambling and building with the parts that, you know, someone else needed, and then on and on and on down the chain, like how it ripples like that too.
What's all this I cubed C rubbish?
I cubed C, that is a new standard that is on our list.
Because there aren't enough standards. So we'll make a new standard and that'll be the standard, the XKCD thing.
Well, anyway. This is just it's the next one, Dave. It's the
This is brand new. Is this analog device? What's this? It's on the planar analog device. It's the I3C, which I'll call the I3C.
Right.
Because this is an update to I2C, right? This is update to the Philips I2C standard.
That's right. Yeah. So Philips was the original. And it was licensed at some point, but you know, it's obviously
it's a trademark thing. If you want to use the I2C name, then you have to pay, well, I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be the case, you had to pay them a trademark, you know, royalty fee, and you had to license. And, you know, back, as you said, like they would give you a license to dress that you could use and all sorts of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, so a lot of companies will just put it, it'll just be like a generic two, they'll just call it two-wire.
Two-wire, or two-wire interface, like TWI.
Yeah, exactly. But it's actually I squared C, right?
That's right.
they just don't want
to. It's all the same thing. Yeah.
Use the trademark, this is I squared C. So who's come up with this?
This is I3C. This paper is from TI.
Oh, it's
But right. I'm guessing, I think the MIPI Alliance is actually doing it. So
MIPI's the thing that a lot of cameras use and stuff, like a serial interface for cameras.
Yeah. And so I think they're probably, I think that's the other thing that's kind of interesting too, is that like back when Philips did the I2C, it's like Philips was just so big and monopolistic, and they, you know, companies didn't really do this this whole standard thing anyways. And now it's like this is a little bit better of a art, you know, of working in alliances and that sort of thing. It's not easy, but...
No. For those who want a history lesson of how I2C started, it was like Philips, of course. This was back in the days of television, none of this digital rubbish, right? Analog television. Philips made a chip for every aspect of a TV. So you'd have the tuner chip, you'd have the filter chip, you know, you'd have like, you know, you'd have the CRT driver chip, you'd have the on-screen fancy-panty ones later in the day. You'd have like an on-screen display chip, and you'd have all these chips. And, you know, a TV would have dozens and dozens of these chips. Philips needed a way. Philips came up with the I2C bus so that they could join all these chips, a standard protocol to join all their own chips together. That's how it came about. It was the standard for TVs.
Right.
Every TV used the I2C, but
whatever you do is a standard then, because you just keep using it internally, and then other people are like, ooh, I want to play.
You just keep using it internally. And then all the other manufacturers went, oh, well, I would like to talk to the I2C. I would like to make a chip that talks to the I2C bus, please. I want part of that action. And they went, we'll license it to you. And, you know, and then just,
And I think, you know, luckily we are getting back to the age of chip companies buying each other and being massive enough. So they just get to make their own standards again. So why not? Yeah, we're back there.
So I don't see any technical detail in here. Is this still like a pull-up base? Because I can't, it's 33, like in ternary mode, it's 33 megabits per second. I have a hard time believing you could do that without like an active pull-up or something. Does it use an active pull-up? Because basically the speed limit of an I2C bus, you should know this, right? This is bread and butter, is that it uses usually a 2.2K pull-up resistor, right? But then the capacitance of your line limits the, you know, you've got an RC charge constant, time constant, and that limits the slew rate and that limits the speed of your bus. So is this like an active pull-up? I assume it's like still a two-wire thing. I don't see any details.
Yeah, I just linked you a wiki page about it as well. I think it is. Let's see. 2016, there was some stuff, some early stuff. Oh, wow. It's been around for a while, actually.
Oh, there's a Venn diagram. It's half I2C and half SPI.
It seems like this is still... Yeah, so it seems like this has been a long time coming, but it definitely is like a superset type of thing. Yeah, like Dave mentioned, the superset or the Venn diagram shows it like crossing over with SPI as well, which is kind of nuts. But
it's part of the new DDR5 standard. That's interesting.
Yeah,
that'd be for memory chip configuration or something, maybe.
Yeah, the thing that I don't understand about all this stuff though is, it does seem like they're just trying to force more and more stuff on. You know, they're trying to make like a mid-range bus, which is still like
It's driven. Like it's a not jack LVDS. Of all trades. It's,
exactly. And what?
Yeah.
And so like, I don't know. I just think I2C is like, it's going to be slow and it's going to be, you know, it's not super noise resistant.
But that's all you need. But a good lot of time that's all you need. You just need need to update a few bytes in a real-time clock chip or something. I don't know.
Exactly. I need to take a temperature on some other part of my board. I need to get that across the board, and like I can just, you know, put pull-ups at either end and I'm good to go. I can slow down the clock if it doesn't look good, right? So like that, but it does get, I mean, by yours truly included, like it does get bastardized quite often and like loaded down with lots and lots of sensors, and you know, there are limitations on addressing as well, you know. So if you have the same sensor, you don't have address switching, you need to insert like a I2C controller or switching chip that handles that sort of stuff. So it does get overused a little bit sometimes, but I'm not sure how then this plays into it as well.
Right. I still can't find any info on the hardware layer. I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's there somewhere. Meh.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. It's trying to bridge the gap between Spybus and I2C. And it's like, do we need to? I don't.
Well, and I think this kind of comes back to like the Daveism that's like, it doesn't exist until it's on DigiKey, right? And it's like, and I think that that's a pretty good rule, especially in this case. Like, we'll have to worry about it when we see it on microcontrollers and parts that we actually care about.
Yes.
I'm actually much more concerned about, what was it? Oh, on the new Nordic chip we talked about a couple weeks ago, the 54H20.
Right.
So they don't have 3.3 volts. They only have one bank out of all of their IO that has 3.3 volts.
Oh, one bank? Is that it?
One bank, yeah.
Usually it's chip wide.
I think it's because they're moving down on the size of the like they're on like 22 nanometer now.
Right.
And like just starts to not be realistic. So then you have to go external with like a power controller. And that worries me a little bit more than this sort of stuff. You know, like
just
because and it's like sensors are also going that way. It's not like there's not sensors available, but just like the multiple power domains. Like I'm just finally getting my brain.
It really got annoying when, you know, everything moved from 5 volt to 3.3. It's like, you don't have 5 volt compatible IO anymore. That's annoying.
Right.
And
if we have anyone out there listening who's like, oh, I design cell phones or like I'm on like leading edge stuff, they're like shouting right now.
Tell someone who cares, but like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, like we're
just working on our industrial widgets, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like slow and slow, baby. Low and slow.
feels like we've just gotten used to the fact that, oh, okay, it does it. You just assume everything doesn't have 5 volt IO anymore. Tolerant. And that's fine, right? I seem to have like just accepted that now, you know?
Yeah, and there are still some specialized ones, like the new Arduino thing that's using a Renesas chip that's 5 volt tolerant. But I think it's also like they chose it because they know people are going to be trying to shove 12 volts in.
There's all backward compatible. Yeah, backward compatible boards and whatnot, hats or whatever they are.
Shields. Yeah.
Shields, things.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. What's the world coming to?
Well, you know, just more and more standards. I've been playing around a little bit with CAN, which is an old standard as well.
No. You're in the automotive. That's, to me, CAN is like, it's just in cars and that's it. It's like...
That's a lot of it, yeah. But it's also like it bleeds over into other...
Yeah, it can do.
Mobile industries, basically, like things that have... Basically anything that has like a motor controller and a battery system as well, it's probably going to have a CAN bus.
Okay, but, right. So like a humanoid robot or something might have a CAN bus,
robots,
for example.
Scooters, that sort of thing. Yeah, right, it's all the same kind of stuff there.
Yep.
I'm not doing like a lot of active work on it. I'm mostly like reviewing someone else's work. But I played with it a very, very little bit. And what a hot mess. There's no standardization at all. Basically, I think this is maybe the same kind of effect that we're talking about here, where the companies are just so big and I think secretive as well. You know, think about like automotive companies that they just, you know, so CAN is basically like it is the physical layer. And I think one layer up from that in like the OSI diagrams.
Basically, well, in the automotive market, they're playing for all the marbles, right? You're not going to share. You're not going to be friendly with your competitors, right? You're going to lock in that standard for yourself so that the car designer has to buy your chips, right? They don't want a second source, right?
They write all of the rules for their subcontractors and all like the OEMs. And the OEMs might make the same thing for Toyota and Mitsubishi, but they might be completely different communication standards. It might be the same hardware with completely different firmware.
Right. Yeah.
And like, yeah. So then, you know, and everything just is like shouting on the bus, you know, it's just like such a noisy, rude bus, like, you know,
noisy, and, rude bus. It's the Ethernet of serial buses, is it?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, the Ethernet standard is incredibly rude. It's just like you can jump on there anytime you like, and then they'll tell you to bugger off. Stop. And then then you come back at another random time and try and try to annoy the bus again. And if it happens to be available, yay, winner. Otherwise, you keep trying at another random time. It's bloody. Yeah. Is there a ruder bus? Is there a ruder bus than the Ethernet? Rude buses can be the name of this episode.
Yeah, I like that.
What do you think? Rude buses.
I like it.
Yep. Yep. And you can have like a bar, you can do the mid-journey thing and get a, well, after this, we'll do a mid-journey battle and see who can generate the best.
Okay. All right.
Rude bus. Photo. Oh boy.
Yeah. I think with Can, I've used a similar kind of thing on like a bastardized RS-45 in the past. And it was like the same kind of thing where it was like basically lowest address wins. And so at least Can is a little bit kinder in that, like, you basically, like, everybody shouts their address first, I think.
Yeah.
And then whatever's listening for it, then you respond. It's kind of like somewhere between an Ethernet and a I2C in that there is specific addressing though as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it's I hopefully have more to report later, but it is an interesting space to be in for sure.
Oh well.
Yeah.
What else we got this week?
What else do we have?
Oh, I do like Practical Engineering's video on how sensors keep bridges from collapsing. So have you worked with strain gauges at all?
No, just like not in any practical context, just, you know, like
they are very cool. Strain gauges are very cool. Like, you can super glue them to any, you know, I've super glued them to all sorts of weird and wonderful things, and or you know, used epoxy or some other thing to attach them, and you know, you can measure the stress and strain on your product. If you've got a physical product, then learning how to use strain gauges is a really useful thing, you know. So
and he's showing it like with a kind of an industrial, so he is actually epoxying it. He shows an I-beam, and then he stands on the I-beam and he shows the deflection, and it's like much more than I would have guessed, you know. Like, if
you can get really minute deflection, you can measure really minute stuff with a strain gauge. They're really remarkable. For those who don't know what a strain gauge is, in this instance, it's basically a printed resistor in like a zigzaggy pattern, you know, a big, you know, back and forth zigzaggy pattern thing that you that's like on like a Mylar sheet. I mean, there's many different ways to do it, but like, you know, often the ones you'll get are on like a Mylar sheet. So they printed this resistive thing, and then you glue down that Mylar sheet to your steel beam or whatever, and then when that Mylar sheet stretches, then the trace on there stretches and it changes its resistance. So you put it in a Wheatstone bridge thing, which is very good. A Wheatstone bridge of configuration, of course, is very good at picking up minute differences in a resistance, and then it will give you a differential output, and then you can amplify that and you can get, it just changes the resistance ever so slightly.
Right. And it's already pretty high resistance to start with too, isn't it?
They're quite high. So like fractionally, some of them could be hundreds of ohms. You know, it depends. Oh, okay. All right. Right. You know.
Yeah.
Yep. And very cool. Very cool strain.
What did you use? So when you said you did it for products, like, what were you measuring the strain on a product?
Oh, because we were manufacturing towed array streamers for not only, well, I worked on submarine ones. I've worked on ones for surveying oil and stuff like that. So they drag behind a boat. So everything is torsional and you know, everything's flexing. Everything's, you know.
But is it the case that you're measuring usually, or is it like the actual circuit
board? Oh, it can be case. It can be strain on wiring harnesses. It can be strain shells that hold hydrophones and transducers.
Yeah, I can
and
imagine
other
pressure
and
vessels for sure. Would definitely
all
be like
sorts
a
of stuff, right?
Thing.
It's stress and strain measurement. And I actually built my own amps for that. You know, so you build up your own amplifiers. You know, really precision. So you use a nice analog devices. You know, differential amp. You know, with bugger all offset, and you know, really nice, really nice stuff. You know, the chip is like $20. And,
That's great.
Yeah. That's awesome. Really fun stuff.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Anyway, I will have to watch that. That'll be my lunchtime video today.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Anyway. That's a good one.
Yep. Very, very, once again, that's another tool to have in your toolkit. You know, if somebody goes, like if you're working at a company and you happen to be manufacturing some sort of physical product, you can go, I can measure to see at what point that fails or at what, you know, see if it has any impact or, you know, things like that. So, yeah.
this is going to sound stupid, but I remember the first time that someone like just had a thermocouple and they were like, yeah, I'll just measure the, I just like glue it to this thing and just measure the temperature. Like, yeah, it was like a chip or something like that. I was like,
magic.
Oh yeah. You could just do that.
You can do like, that. You can learn so much.
I know that's like a thing that now I'm like, yeah, of course you would. But like then I was like, wait, you can just do that? You can just measure the temperature like that? And yeah, you can. It's actually a really good way to do it.
Can we come up with a list of valuable skills that you wouldn't, like, you know,
I have a particular
gauge
set of skills
that
if you take
need
my product. Yeah. Yeah. If you take my product, I will find you.
Liam, channel our inner Liam Neeson. And for those who don't get the reference, Taken,
of course. Yeah.
Right. And like, you know, thermal imaging, thermal measurement.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Stress measurement with these strain gauges that we're talking about. I've done videos on vibration measurement using accelerometers and stuff, right? Very useful skill for, you know, is my PCB going to survive transport? Is my PCB going to survive in an operational mode, right? Huge, valuable skill to have.
How would you do that now? Like,
exactly the same way. You would glue an accelerometer, super glue. You get an accelerometer, a little miniature one. And you would super glue it to your PCB, often in multiple locations, often in multiple orientations, because you want to shake it in different orientations. But you can use just one if you want and then mount your board in different configurations when you shake it, you know, vertical, horizontal,
and like
diagonal.
Wire it off board and just measure it like out of a DAC or something like that?
Yeah. You send it into a charge amplifier and then you send that into a dynamic signal analyzer, which then you can get the frequency sweep of, so you know the resonant point of your PCB, like how it's mounted. So your PCB, I've got this giant PCB and it's only got four mounting points in the corners and I've got this real heavy transformer in the middle. Well, dude, you're going to come and guts right?
Resonant frequencies, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Just transporting your product on the truck to go to your customer can damage it, right? So there are standards for all these things. There's standards for transport of products. And you can test that your product meets those transport standards by rail, by road, by air, by ship, and all sorts of things, right?
Yeah, that's great.
It's a huge rabbit hole there. And if you've got the skills to do that, you're an invaluable employee, right?
Yeah, that's great. I think I forget where I was talking about. I think this might have been at work, but I was talking to someone about like the importance of getting off your bench because like, it's so easy to like lull yourself into a false sense of security. Like, of course, I've like done all this testing on my bench and like it works great.
but then
you said, like, you know, it's in your pocket and like, oh, a corner, you know, like a exposed or like something on the board shorts to the case and the chassis and then it just like shorts out or something.
Or simply getting it outside. Oh, it's in the sun. Yeah. Oh, it's in 40 the sun, degrees right, exactly. now. Yeah, oh, it's not 20 like, degrees in the lab. Oh, it's snowing outside. It's 0 degrees. Yeah. Ugh, does my battery work? I don't know.
Right. And just like, I think that would have been great advice to my younger self of just like, get it in situ as fast as possible, even though it's not perfect yet. Like whatever amount of jewelry rig I need to do of like super glue and tape and whatever to get it into a real enough situation. That is like, that's another skill I feel like that is important because I especially feel like young Chris and sometimes current Chris, there's like that safety of being on the bench. And like,
totally.
It's a learned behavior to move it off the bench quickly.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, you're going to find so many more problems that you're going to save yourself many late night engineering adventures. I feel like not the good kind.
That's one aspect of my rather boring career, my boring professional career that I'm actually glad of is that I worked on stuff that's used in the field, that's used in extreme environments, whether it's the bottom of the ocean, whether it's towed behind a ship, whether it's used on the back deck of the ship in 60 degree hot sun, you know, and also, you know, weird, like whether it's dropped from a helicopter. I've designed products that have to survive being dropped from a helicopter into the ocean, right? Huge impact forces. So shock, temperature, vibration, transport, all these sorts of, you know, temperature extremes, all these sorts of things that, you know, I've had experience in has taught me quite a lot of valuable skill. It's taught me the importance that those things actually happen in the real world. So,
And I think just kind of like, It's almost like being a prepper for your own board.
Right, prepper, electronics prepper. Yeah. Right.
All the things that could go wrong, you kind of just, you trigger them. You do drills. Yeah, yeah. You know, like.
So, you know, or whether or not you're designing a product for, you know, for that kids use, you know, you'd be surprised at the abuse that kids will, you know, put on a product or something like that. It's easy to design on the bench and everyone comes up and, oh, it works. They press the buttons nice and gently and, you know, like,
I feel like having like in situ battery testing too, like with like real use case, you know, so like if you could get it again, like you could do a battery test on your bench and measure the, you know, the discharge curve, whatever, but can you also potentially measure it when it's in someone's pocket and they've depressed one of the buttons by accident and like that actually is draining the battery as well because the light's on or something like that, you know, like all of these other failure modes that are just real world type of stuff. I don't know. How do you get to those points faster and still hopefully measure them?
Right. That gives me an idea for a video.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. I mean, this is a definitely good fodder for a video of like it's like a boot camp. It's like a boot camp.
Yeah, it could be like top five skills you need to know.
Dave Jones boot camp of measurements. And then you top could actually like put on a hat and skills. Whistle.
Yeah,
and...
yeah, right. Yeah, right. I think I might.
Listen up, maggots. I'm going to teach you how to shake a box so hard your circuit board falls apart.
That makes a good whiteboard. You know.
Nah, whiteboard. Come on, man.
What? Nah,
put some theatrics into it. Come on.
Yeah, come on.
Ah, come on. It's really easy for me to say as someone not doing all the recording. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You should spend a little more time on that, Dave.
Right, okay. Oh, no, I just want to churn out cheap and easy content, you know. Boy. Anyway. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, valuable skills. Those skills that you don't learn these, right? You don't learn these in your typical engineering course, right?
No, it's you learn like, them on-site you from learn them someone on-site who's already later. Been through it. Yeah.
There is no course on vibration testing. You know, hands up.
Oh, there is, but it might be.
Maybe, but it's some niche thing that nobody. You know.
This is why co-ops are important. I think that's the, because there, if there's one job they're also going to make the co-op do, it's monitoring the vibration test. Yeah. I mean, that was, many of my friends had that as well.
Yeah, but the thing is, like if you work at a company, you get work experience at a company and all they do is design, you know, some little PCB that doesn't get used in, you know, any real, like, you know, any like harsh environment or something like that, then you're not going to consider any of these things.
See, that's another tact you could take on the video of like things to look for in jobs, like internships, right? That would be definitely one of them.
Okay, that's an interesting take. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I definitely remember thinking, I remember thinking that like, I want to go do an internship at Intel, right? That was like, that was like the top spot. And then the one guy that did it, he came back and he's like, yeah, I was reading Verilog in a cube for 8 hours a day for all summer.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, of course, you know.
Yeah, right. Duh, of course, you know. So all we got out of that is, well, valuable Verilog skills, but the...
I mean, probably a lot of money too.
And the prestige of having that name on you.
Yeah, it could springboard you into another thing, you know, seeing Intel on a resume might help the next internship or your first job, whatever, but it also might mean you're just put into another cube.
Yeah, right. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I'm gonna think about a video.
All right, we've started the Dave engine here. Yep. Well, your imagination is spinning. Mine is spinning from yet another antenna simulation from Sam. Is that his name?
Sam A. I think.
Sam A. Yes. So if people saw, I think we mentioned this on the show a couple weeks ago. He tagged us on Twitter with like a simulation of a transmission line. And it was like an overlay of a Blender thing. And then he overlaid like the simulation using OpenEMS. And it was like, you could see the reflections. Super cool. Well, this new one, I really like this, but we talked about it a little bit as well about whether it's actually useful, is a Wi-Fi.
We talked about this just briefly before the show. It's like, it's very cool to see what he's done. It is so cool to see.
Like, you have to go watch this right now. We will link in it, of course. But is it useful in a troubleshooting and or like design context? That's actually an interesting question.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about before. We were discussing this before the show and going, this looks really cool. And then it dawned on me, what am I actually looking at? Is this useful information to me?
Right. Because I had said to Dave, I said, I would love to be able to see this kind of like visualization of like, you know, it's so just as like an audio picture here, it's basically, it's an F antenna and off of like, I think it's the TI recommended F antenna for like a 2.4 gigahertz.
Yep.
And then it's like the waves propagating off of this thing. And again, It looks so cool. But I had said to Dave, like, I've always wanted this in like a smart glasses kind of thing. You could like see this in the world. So you could see, you know, waves coming off your Wi-Fi router or your,
and then,
you know,
how does it couple into the receiving antenna is another thing. Right. Like, how does it like, yeah.
But does it actually change like your design stuff? So like, I think the, one of the key things that neither Dave or I have is like, okay, now you see this, what are you going to do to make it better or worse? Like, that's really a missing piece there that neither of us have. Like, we're not going to be like, oh,
we don't have
at the end, that 90 degrees should be 80
intuition.
Degrees, you know?
Yeah, we don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, no, apart from the fact that, okay, I'm not going to put that next to a metal object, or I'm not going
right.
to have the user's hand covering it or something like that. Right. You know, common sense stuff like that, right? But but apart from that, it's like, well, I don't know, keep the antenna as far away from metal and humans and other objects as possible. And Bob's your uncle, you know, kind of like rule of thumb.
I mean,
I don't know.
I think there are some RF experts that would have more knowledge and use case for this sort of thing. But that actionable intelligence, not for us so much.
It's really more of a skill for if you are designing the shoe phone, you know, you're designing the latest Apple shoe phone and you have to integrate the antenna on the PCB, you're going to go to town, right? You're going to ride that donkey all the way into town, right? Yeah. Trying to figure out how, you know, like every minute detail of how that antenna radiates, right? Yeah. That's super important. But, you know, I don't know. Yeah, it's cool. But I can't see how I can practically, how that gives me a practical insight.
Right. Well, I think this is kind of like a, if we zoom out a little bit from this, these absolutely gorgeous renderings, and we should just restate them. Sam, very nice job. This is, please keep making these. I will look at these all day long. but like generally, I think as well, like simulation has tons of value, but again, like then what is your action as a result? I think at this point, this is one of the things where I think I've talked to Mr. Jeffrey Kaiser about this before too. And I say like, well, what do you do then? What is knowledge? And Jeff's like, look, you got to go back to fundamentals at that point then, right? You need to make sure you understand your R's and your C's and your L's, and that you understand how signals normally propagate in a best case scenario, worst case scenario, whatever. And I'm like, oh, right. I don't have that.
Exactly. Or I've forgotten it, you know.
I've forgotten it.
I've totally forgotten it. There's no way I'm getting it back.
right. And I think the other thing too is that, like, you know, so Sam's showing a inverted F antenna here with like the recommended pattern. If it doesn't work, I wouldn't say you go and if it doesn't work how you expect it to, I wouldn't go and start tweaking an antenna at that point. You know what I mean? I'd be like, really be digging in to make sure, like, is it not working because I did something wrong? Because like, this is a proven, like,
or is it not
reference design over and over again?
Because I use the wrong dielectric PCB. Is it not working because other components are too close to it? Is it?
Exactly.
You know, have I got the wrong impedance trace going to it? You know, like.
Right. Yeah. And if you start from something like that well-known and like that, like, and something that is in a reference design, not like you can't find it, but like the default assumption should always be like, what did I do versus what did they do? You know, it's not like I need to go and change the geometry here. It's like, no, I need to understand the actual situation first. And that's actually, I think, where simulation could help you kind of dig in a little bit more and like understand more about it, because it's putting visuals to something that is not in the visual spectrum. So that part's always really tough.
You do know that everyone's just screaming at it. Everyone who knows stuff is just screaming at it. It's going, oh, you guys have no clue. Just shut up.
Well, they ain't wrong. They ain't wrong.
Exactly. but anyway, good stuff.
Well, we're not making RF stuff that often anyways. I mostly buy prefabbed RF stuff. Thank you very much. Which is a pretty good solution. The correct answer is buy stuff with SMA cables on it or SMA
right,
connectors.
Yes. And so, yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Okay. What else we got?
I don't know if we have much time for much else. Yeah.
Because our amp hour is up. Last thing. I did like... Electro Boom, former guest.
Yep.
Made a very cool looking lamp, a fire, like a fire. He calls it a firefight lamp. I guess it is. But it's got little inductive LEDs inside that, you know, light up and dance around, and, you know, it's a fan at the bottom and flies them around, and, you know, it's cool.
In the in certain parts of the U.S., including where I grew up, they were called lightning bugs, not fireflies. Okay.
Right. There you go.
That's actually a way you can tell where people grew up in the U.S. is what they called the things that light up their bums.
got it. Yeah. Yeah. And somebody did a smart teardown of, I didn't know Ray-Ban are doing smart glasses.
Yeah, Becky did this. Yeah. Yep.
And
yep.
What the hell but why are we doing stuff? I thought they went the way of the dodo, smart glasses.
I am surprised actually that they're still doing this. Yeah. I mean, cause like, what's their name? Snapchat? That other? No. Yeah. Another Snapchat. Snapchat was another social media thing.
Oh yes. Right. Yeah. Snapchat.
Prior
oh,
to TikTok.
God. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They had glasses as well that were a little bit chunkier than this. The Ray-Ban ones, they look kind of normalish.
Yeah, but what do they do? What do you use them for? What's the killer app? What's the, you know?
Oh, actually, Dave, I happen to be holding my Google Glass.
Your ancient Google
headphone
Glass.
Jack. In my hand, it's actually the headphone thingy is actually on my desk for some reason. And
the ultimate
I'm
novelty
playing with
that
it as we speak.
Wore
yeah.
off.
I think the only thing that was actually good about it was like having something in situ and like that is you don't have to pull your there's always the creepy factor. There's no denying that there is the creepy factor, but being able to like capture quasi decent photos at the drop of a hat without pulling out a phone is so different.
Right.
And like, and not, I'm not going to say liberating because it's not, it feels like that's like a religious experience or something like that, but it's
just a convenience
it's
thing.
So much
it's
more
right,
convenient.
It's right on your head. And what are you to take a photo? You just tap the double tap the side
tap.
Or something.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know on the Ray-Ban ones, but it is having ubiquitous like camera is like, you get to like,
well, see,
just have this, like,
see for me,
this, like,
that is probably the killer app. Don't make it do anything else. Don't make it do any of the bullshit projection stuff. Just double click the side. Like it's always on sleeping. And then when you double tap the side, it takes a photo of whatever you're looking at. And then it beeps to confirm that it's taken it.
Totally.
So you don't have to check. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
and
like,
if you want to check, you later, you go look at your phone and you can download the photo.
You build
it,
up confidence in it that, yep, if it's beeped, yep, it's taken the photo and it's got a wide angle, fixed focus, you know, like.
I think that's pretty much what this is doing, right? I mean, because it's trying to kind of replicate just like the eyeballs. It's like you're looking at someone else's eyeballs. That is an interesting perspective from like a filmmaker kind of thing too, right? It's not a common perspective, even if you put a phone in front of your face. And it's not like it gets stereolithic.
Yeah, what's this 3D heat map modeling thing, software they got? They've got like an X-ray
Think sponsored the video. That's like a scanner thing.
Right.
Yeah. That is, what is it called?
I just want to know how that's working. How they
that's
got a
that is a CAT scan. You remember how I showed you a CAT scan at one point?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it is a CAT scan.
Spinning the thing around. They've got the model. And so they must have mapped it. So they must have put it in this big 3D mapping X-ray box, scanner box thing, and then got a 3D X-ray of it or something, and they're able to.
Yeah, that is. So I had access to one of those at MHub when I was there, and I think they still have it there. But it was it wasn't a CAT scan. Sorry, it was a CT scan.
Yeah,
and then there was like software they layered on top of it. This looks pretty similar. This actually looks. Is it Lumafield? Is that who it is? I think it's Lumafield.
Don't know. Anyway.
And so I think that's who is doing this stuff.
Okay.
But I think they were one of the quasi-sponsors of this video as well.
Okay.
I don't know. I know one of the people that's there. I met one person who's there. So, it's definitely cool software, though. Yeah.
Anyway, it's very impressive. Anyway, I'm kind of jealous of...
Sure
it's
not cheap. Yeah. Not cheap in the slightest. It would be very, very expensive. But I think like the sort of thing where like, you know, when you need it, you really need it sort of thing.
Yeah.
So like same with that CT scan that I did. It was, I actually got a friend's manufacturing problem board and like he had like, this actually looks like this is not CT scan because doesn't have high enough resolution.
Right.
The one that I was doing, like it actually had like, remember I showed you like the BGA balls, like you could actually see voiding underneath, you can get 3D viewing and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, so
it's magic.
So cool. And like when you need it, you really, really need it, you know?
Right.
So, cause you're captive underneath parts Becky does this teardown and she actually shows there's a Qualcomm chip with like encapsulate like top by memory, you know, so like the, how they do memory stacked on top of processing chips as well.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. So very, very complex assemblies like that. You kind of just, you can't really take it apart at that point. You just kind of, need something to look inside of it, you know?
Yeah. So, very cool.
Great video. Great video. Yeah. I like these kind of things.
I have to watch the whole thing. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it. Our MPL is up.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck with Steve next week. Tell him I said hello, even though he doesn't know me.
He doesn't know you from Bar of Soap, dude.
Please send my regards. Please send my regards and that, you know, I like their parts. Blah, blah, blah. Thanks for being on the Amp Hour.
Right.
And please stick around for a whole hour, Steve. That's the other thing.
All right.
And if you listen, Steve, if you're listening to this, or if one of your staff members is, more likely, ignore what we said about your parts prior in the early in the show.
That cancellation email is coming through right now.
There it is. Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Catch you next time.
See ya.